Hi there, we really hope you enjoy this teaching from the Message Trust. To find out more about all the exciting things we're doing, check out our website, message.org.uk.
It's great to be with you guys here this morning and just sharing some stuff about fundraising. Just to introduce myself a little bit first, so I'm a fundraising and charity consultant. I have my own sort of business called Kingdom Fundraising. And I've been doing that for the last year, but my kind of background in fundraising goes back a decade, really, and it really did start for me with Eden. This is my beautiful family. I can't start without introducing, and there's my wife there, and I've got two kids, Daniel, who's five, and Poppy, who's almost two. And I was just sharing Sam this because I really enjoyed looking at some of these old photos of when I was a youth and community worker for Eden. And so I get Eden, and I get the heart behind it. And this is one of the highlights of my time as a youth worker was when we got an opportunity to take some of our football lads from the estate to a trip to Norway. And we had to fundraise for that to get the money. And actually, would I go to Norway again? No, because it's flipping expensive. We took them, as we were waiting to get on one of the boats, we took them for a game of pool and a drink somewhere, and that was like our entire budget wiped out just from that like one thing. So, but it was incredible, and four of the guys gave their lives to Jesus on that trip and got baptized out there. So it was amazing, real highlight for me and the work we did. And it was just a great real privilege actually to be part of the same team as Sam Ward as well, because you know he's a quality guy, and being involved in that in the work over there in East Manchester. And just to draw your attention to this, it all came together in our final season. We were unbeaten. And I was just saying to Simon from Eden Hattersley, one of our most notorious games is when Eden Openshaw played Eden at Hattersley. And I think one of our lads who was a little bit, I don't know, very competitive, and he got tackled in a bad way or something and said, right, coming back with my cousin. And he comes back with a machete and his cousin. And then all the Eden Hattersley boys are like, what? And they go to their cars and pull out golf clubs. So suddenly we've got this crazy thing happening. So I've really had it all. We've had our house like smashed with eggs and mud and, you know, from the lads because I had to like discipline someone from the week before, you know, and they weren't allowed to play. So I've got all that kind of background. From Eden, just to show you a little bit of the journey that I've been on, just to give you a bit more of the experience, I really prayed that I'd get more project management experience and project development, and had an opportunity to work with Deborah Green at ROC, Redeeming Our Communities. And the role that I had there was as the National Development Manager, with a particular focus on helping churches work with statutory agencies to set up youth projects and community projects and stuff like that. And a lot of that involved funding, helping those churches and organisations access funding from various places. And I did that for close to 3 years. And then the national thing wasn't as appealing when I started a family. I didn't want to be travelling as much. And I got a job working for a Catholic charity called Caritas, and they're a social welfare charity. After British Red Cross, they're actually the second biggest developmental charity worldwide. They're a large charity, and I was just working for the Northwest kind of Diocese of Salford base. And my role there was as service manager for community services. So I oversaw 12 different community projects, helped them develop, helped them sustain, manage the managers in those projects and all that kind of work. And then about a year ago, after my wife was finishing maternity leave, we felt like God was actually calling me to step back from that position so that I could work part-time and help with the childcare of our daughter, which is good fun. I really enjoy it. And hard work as well. I've got a new appreciation of what looking after children means. It's because we're also part of a church here. So Hannah, my wife, leads Ivyshire Austin Church that meet here at the Message Trust every Sunday. So I'm part of the leadership team here. So I set up Kingdom Fundraising because I was kind of just asking God, what is it in my skill set that actually might be useful to others? What is it that actually there's so many charities, Christian organisations out there that are doing great work, but this is always the question that people come to is how can I secure funding? How can I help to resource the mission and the vision that God's given me? So that was something I thought, right, I'm going to set this up. And I haven't stopped working since then, and I've worked for a number of different charities. The first one was a charity called Dignity that worked out in Zambia, which has stretched me because my focus really has always been UK-related work. That's kind of my expertise and experience. But I've been out to Kenya with another charity since then and then helped lots of different charities, Christian churches in the UK. I'm also a trustee for a grant-giving charity. So three grant-giving charities that give out money. We meet once a month and we have three pots of funding, one that's for adults and families in crisis, one that's for children specifically under the age of 25, and the other one is a kind of medical needs, so stuff that perhaps NHS can't cover. People might need extra funding for kind of medical related stuff. It is only Manchester focused, I'm afraid, so if you're coming from all over, you won't be able to access that funding. But for me, it's actually quite nice to be able to give people's money out as well as like asking for it. So yeah, that's a bit of my background. And I just wanted to find out really a little bit from yourselves. And just as a kind of survey, just interested to know where people are kind of up to in fundraising. So if you've come here today and you feel actually you've got quite a good understanding of fundraising and securing grant funding, you put your hand up. Simon's a wobble. Wow, you're in the right place. That's good. Hands up if you're just starting that journey. Okay. How many of you are sort of part of registered charities or affiliated to organisations that are registered charities like churches? Yeah, great. And is funding for the project work that you do like quite an urgent priority for you right now? Yeah, or is it just something you're starting to think with? Okay. That's helpful, just to get that picture. I'm really passionate about Christian charities and churches accessing the funding that's out there, because I think we do so much in society, and it's not just the kind of more proclamational stuff, the sharing of the gospel, but actually so much of the work that churches and Eden teams do have massive social outcomes and social outputs that are helping communities in lots of ways, which actually mean that they are eligible to apply for lots of funding. And we're going to look in a bit more detail of that. But my hopes really for this seminar is really that your spiritual viewpoint on fundraising might be changed, that you'll be encouraged to kind of have a go at it and keep going, and that you'll pick up some tips and some tools and some resources today to really get you going on that journey of writing. I just want to start by just referencing this book. Quite a few people that I know that are successful fundraisers. It's only a small book. It's written by Henry Nguyen. And it's a fantastic little read that really helped to transform my view of fundraising and what that kind of looks like. And I just want to read a short extract from that just to help set us off today. And it says this: fundraising is a subject we seldom think about from a spiritual perspective. We may think of fundraising as a necessary but unpleasant activity to support spiritual things. Or we might believe that fundraising reflects a failure to plan well or to trust enough that God will provide for all our needs. Indeed, quite often fundraising is a response to crisis. Suddenly our organisation or faith community does not have enough money. So we begin to say, how are we going to get the money we need? We have to start asking for it. Then we realise that we are not used to doing this. We may feel awkward and a little embarrassed about it. We may begin to worry and wonder, who will give us money and how will we ask them? It goes on to say this: from the perspective of the gospel, fundraising is not a response to crisis. Fundraising is first and foremost a form of ministry. Now, this was a bit of a game changer for me, as seeing the work that I do. It's not just an awkward thing or something to be embarrassed about, but it's actually a ministry in its own right. And it's a way of announcing our vision and inviting other people into our mission. Vision and mission are so central to the life of God's people that without vision we perish, and without mission we lose our way. Proverbs 29, 2 Kings 21. Vision brings together needs and resources to meet those needs. Acts 9. Vision also shows us new directions and opportunities for our mission. Acts 16. Vision gives us the courage to speak when we might remain silent. Acts 18. Fundraising is proclaiming what we believe in such a way that we offer people an opportunity to participate with us in our vision and mission. So it is... It's exciting that we have this vision and purpose that God's called us to do in the work that we're doing, and that actually we're seeking people to come alongside that and fundraise for that. So it's not an awkward thing by any stretch of the imagination. Just to say, for me personally, what separates me from every other kind of more secular grant writer is prayer. And I think it was just said in the session earlier, actually how essential it is that you start with prayer and thanksgiving. And I think some of the most successful grants that I've secured have been because I've been prayerful as I've written them, but prayerful as I've asked God to release that funding to the organized, you know, the projects that I've been seeking. I believe I'm actually an undiagnosed dyslexic. I actually struggle with words. One of my biggest regrets is not doing English at college. I did maths and physics and then went on to do history and politics at uni. But I really regret that I didn't do English. And I think, but there are, for people that struggle with words and struggle in that way, that shouldn't be a barrier. And some of the things out there, word processors are great for correcting stuff. But there's also something, I don't know if you've come across it, called Grammarly, which is a plugin you can download for free that plugs into your internet browser and helps correct and autocorrect grammar and spelling and stuff like that. So if that is a barrier for you, you know, don't worry. And for me as well, I don't have any qualifications in fundraising. It's purely come from starting from that place in Eden and looking at how can I get $2,000 for my football team. And that's how it started for me. And since then, you know, in the last 2 years, I've secured over £1 million for different charities and organisations. So the biggest grant that I secured was £350,000. And the smallest was up to like £500. So there's a whole spectrum out there and available. Just want to talk a little bit about fundraising returns. So grant writing is just one aspect of fundraising. It's just the area that I have more specialism in. There are lots of other ways, as you'll be aware. I took this from a report from the Institute of Fundraising, and they just looked at some of the top charities. They did a report on 16 charities, 17 charities with a total income of £1.13 billion. So some of the big boys. And they participated in the study. And this was from 2013. The net trading cost, the total income for those charities from grant writing, from voluntary income, which includes grant writing, was about £1 billion. So half a billion of their income comes from fundraising of some kind. And as you can see, they've got different aspects: legacies, committed giving, local fundraising, corporate, special events, competitions. I think it's really important as a charity and organisation that you don't depend on any one area, that you actually have a diverse income stream coming from different areas. That can be from events in your community. And stuff like that is fantastic because it's unrestricted money. For the most part, you can use it where it's most needed, unless you're very specific about what you're fundraising for. And in terms of the return on the investment, the Institute of Fundraising doesn't like talking about this, but this again was based on the study with these 17 fundraisers. So if you think about every £1 that was invested by those charities, this gives you an indication of the kind of level of returns that they were getting. So you probably can't see it, but the first one, trusts, so every £1, so back in 2013, those charities were seeing a £9.50 return that they invested. For committed giving, it was £6, corporate, so companies, £4.20, major donors, £2.97, Special events, £2.38, £2.06 for local fundraising competitions, £1.91, direct marketing, £1.51, and other voluntary income, £4.20. So the total that is actually for voluntary income, roughly for charities, every £1 that they invest in fundraising, they're getting about £4.20. And I think for us, maybe that can help if we're trying to think about sourcing income, actually some of the returns that we should be thinking about and help to kind of as a bit of a strategy. And for me, and obviously trust there is kind of offering one of the greatest returns on your potential investment. And it's not just every pound, but it's your time and the resources and your energy that you would invest in that. There's actually a potentially quite a good return on your investment. So how much is there out there? This was taken from a report on the top 300 charitable trusts, which said that they distribute about £2.7 billion per year. And this equates to 15% of all the voluntary income. There's a resource that I'm going to be talking about later that you might have come across already. But actually that said, that evidence is there's actually £5 billion that's being given out by 2,000 trusts. So there's a lot of money out there in the UK that people are accessing all the time that you might not have even been aware of. That really part of today is I want to try and help you think about how you can access that and how you can secure a slice of the cake, if you like, for the work that you do. So there's different types of funding, as you're probably aware, the startup funding, so kind of seed funding, so the kind of kicking off at the beginning, revenue, which is like salaries, people's salaries and other costs, capital, which is it's looking at equipment or buildings, project funding, which can kind of include a contribution towards lots of things like overheads and management time. There's core and long-term funding, but that's quite rare. If you strike up a relationship with a grant maker and they really love you, it could go on for longer. But you're probably looking, even some of the bigger funders, Big Lottery might give a 5-year grant, a 3-year grant in some cases. So it's for a number of years, but what you could do in that time could be incredible. I mean, I was funded at ROC as the National Development Manager by a Big Lottery grant. Now, not every church is comfortable with securing money from that kind of thing, and that is fine, and I respect the wishes of the churches, but for me, it enabled me to do my work, and part of my brief was securing more money for the charity. So what I was able to do in that 3 years was more, really, as a result of that. And some of the funding that we were accessing for youth clubs was proceeds of crime. You know, so money that's come from criminals' activities that the police have taken was funding like our pool table, you know, and table tennis table and stuff like that. So for me, part of it is actually God, I believe, can redeem that money, even if it was brought. Now, I have to say, you still have to be quite careful, you know, organisations out there, a cult, all that kind of stuff, I wouldn't go touch that kind of money. But I do believe, you know, that God can redeem that. So yeah, lots of different, and then there's small grants, and there'll be a kind of, in your different areas and communities, there'll be lots of small grant programs that you'll be able to access. And I think this is a really good way of actually starting on this journey of grant writing. That's where I started. Start small, and gradually you build your confidence, you build your skills, you can refine your application as well, because once you've got it, it's just you keep getting better and better with the feedback that you get. So I think that's really good. And also I think funding, in the US they have this rating system on charities for funding, so you can be a gold star rated or a platinum star rated charity. And to be honest, I don't think it's that helpful really, because it kind of probably limits the smaller organisations that aren't able to get those ratings. But for us in the UK, I think it does funding, once you've secured like a significant grant, so you've got an Awards for All funding, which is £10,000 from Big Lottery, that will open the door to others, because people respect the criteria that Big Lottery have, the what they require back from you in terms of outcomes and measuring outcomes. they'll look at that favorably. So it's almost like you're building up your portfolio gradually, and the longer you do that, the more resources you're able to kind of access. This was a quote from a former boss, and I felt like I had to write his name rather than just steal it. But grant writing is both a science and an art. So there are the two sides to it. There is the kind of structural stuff, the evidence base, the kind of research out there. And Google is fantastic for looking at, you know, scholarly articles and stuff that you might be able to pick a quote from, or some government statistic about youth crime or about mental health. There's lots of great stuff that you could like involve, put in your bid. But it's also the qualitative side and the telling the story. I can't emphasize that enough, that story and why you're doing what you're doing and what you're hoping to do. Saying that as passionately as possible is going to set you apart from lots of other organizations. And it is, for grant writers, it's about impact. People that want to, for me, when we sit down once a month, what we're looking for is that our money that we give to individuals and organizations is going to have a great impact. So if you can gear up your application to show that you are trying to have an impact on people's lives, in whatever way that looks like, whether it's for a Christian charity and actually it's people that you want to be seeing come to do, say, Alpha courses or Youth Alpha that come to be part of the church, or whether it's like you're actually trying to reduce antisocial behaviour in your neighbourhood with young people. There's lots of ways that you can demonstrate the impact. And people are more likely to give to change than just need. So if you're banging on about the need of your community, which is relevant, you know, in Eden and Openshaw, we'd always start with, you know, the indices of deprivation, it was such a deprived area, such a difficult, that's good, but you also need to build on that and be going one step further and talk about the change, the impact that you're going to be having. I was at the Christian charity fundraisers conference in London earlier this year. And it was a massive event that Stewardship put on at Central Hall, Methodist Central Hall in Westminster. And there was a panel of all the kind of major Christian grant givers that were there. And the lady that was from the Henry Smith Trust kind of said, the question was asked about people like me, consultants, and like, should we look at booking consultants to help us? And she said it's really obvious to them when they receive a grant from someone that isn't linked to the project itself. They call them polo applications, like all the structure is there, but actually it's missing the heart. And that's what I'm passionate about when I learn about charities, is making sure I'm working with the people on the ground to really understand the heart. So my message there is really, like, actually, you are the best people to write these grant applications. Like, it might be further down the line that you decide that you need some help with a bigger grant application, and there's people like me around to do that. But actually, starting yourself, you're the best people to do that. And I want you to feel really empowered by that. So I've just, in terms of the quantitative and qualitative, so the numbers versus kind of the story, just got two case studies that I'm going to read out. And I just want you to have a chat to the person next to you and think about what you think are the major differences between these two. So this is based on a real case study of a charity I've worked for recently. And this is the first one. We've been helping Georgina Jones from St. Peter's High School, Stoke-on-Trent, for the last 18 months. Georgina is 13 years old and is quite a vulnerable young person. St. Peter's is located in a very deprived area. She has been coming along to youth sessions and building relationships with our youth workers and volunteers. In that time, she's attended a course we provide and done well. We've seen a significant improvement in Georgina because she has mental health issues and problems. She particularly likes to play pool and do craft with Brian. She's attended 30 sessions this year. Her favourite celebrity personality is Donald Trump. That wasn't part of the original thing. I just threw that in there because I was running out. This is another example of the same story. This is just a one-pager on A4 that you won't be able to read, so I'll read it out. So there's a nice picture there, and it says Focus Youth Case Study, Millie. And there's a star there because we're changing her name and the picture to protect her identity. But actually, this young person, what she was smiling behind it, and this is about her story. Staff from Booth High School referred 12-year-old Millie to Focus Youth's wellbeing hub in the school. Millie was showing signs of rejecting school due to challenges with her mental health. Millie really struggled in the classroom and had very low self-esteem, especially in large groups of children. Millie had parents separated. Millie's parents had separated the previous year, and the decline in her engagement with school started at around the same time. Focus Youth had been working in Booth High School since May 2016, and we've worked hard to develop and establish a relationship of trust with young people, school staff, and the governing body. The success of Focus Youth is providing therapeutic interventions with young people. Has been quite significant. However, an area of ongoing need for the school is with pupils who are struggling due to mental health problems. There is a significant lack of mental health services available in our geographical area. Early interventions can often avoid problems from spiralling and stop potential school exclusions. Social prescribing through social activities like youth clubs and through mentoring is proven to have a dramatic impact on young people who may be struggling in various ways. Millie began meeting with Gemma, one of Focus youth workers. Over time, the relationship grew, and Millie agreed to take part in the beloved course written by Gemma, which really helps to build a young person's confidence and self-esteem and sense of identity in the person you are. Gemma also referred Millie for some sessions with a professional counsellor who worked with Millie for a number of sessions. Millie showed signs of improvement, amazing signs of improvement, and the youth club was prescribed by counsellors so that Millie could continue to flourish in a positive atmosphere. The difference that this early intervention has made has been staggering. It's been noted by staff and parents how much happier Millie is now and how much more engaged she is in the classroom. There's a quote from Millie's mum: "Even after her first session, my daughter has become so open and communicative in a way that I haven't seen for months. It's like having my old daughter back again." Young people's mental health has been described as a worsening crisis in the UK. Academics at University College London, Imperial College London, and the University of Exeter and the Nutfield Trust have found that the proportion of children and young people saying that they have mental health condition has grown sixfold in England over the past two decades. Commenting on the findings, there's a quote there from Dr. Dougal Hargreaves of Imperial College London, who says this: "We know that there's already a growing crisis in the availability of child adolescent mental health services, with many more children, young people needing treatment than the services are able to provide. The study suggests that this need is likely to continue to grow in the future without more radical action to improve access and funding for CAMHS, as well as a wider strategy to promote positive mental health and well-being. We may be letting down some of the most vulnerable in society. I wanted a like-minded person to understand," this is Millie, "I wanted a like-minded person to understand what I was saying and how I was feeling and to help me get past it and my depression. I wanted someone who could be a friend as well. I didn't want someone who was boring or didn't seem engaged in my problems. I wanted someone who'd help and be interested in me and my problems, and I got that. I enjoyed having a mentor who was similar to me, was energetic, showed genuine concerns in the problems, and wanted to help as much as they possibly could." Great. So that was all on one page of A4. So, you know, there's a very big difference between these two case studies. Just have a chat to the person next to you. What were the things that the biggest differences that you've kind of noticed about the two? And then we'll just feedback in a second. Okay. So major differences that you kind of notice in those two stories. Anyone brave enough just to jump in? Yes. Took me a while to read it, but that is size 12 on an A4 piece of paper typed. Still quite a bit in there. I've left quite a bit in there to kind of demonstrate some of the things I'm trying to talk about. Anyone else?
I think the emphasis of character in the second one.
Say again.
I think the emphasis of character in the second one really shows the change.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant.
Particularly the bit at the end where it was saying about how actually this is going to be a problem
for society, not just for this individual young person.
Yeah.
And making the message much wider.
Yeah. So you've gone from taking from a one story of the single issue with that individual, and it's actually you're kind of helping to shape it to say, actually, this is endemic, this is massive.
There's going to be more Middle
East. Yeah, exactly. So you're doing that through the power of story. Yeah.
First one sort of said we have helped, but didn't show any indication he understood why.
Yeah.
Second one sort of by talking about the wider mental health issue, suggested they understood the process of the and why they didn't be able to help others. Whereas first one indicated they could have just been lucky.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's demonstrating that actually you're a bit more intentional about the relationships you've got with these young people. And you've got respected relationships with the school and other agencies. You know, all of that's really good to be able to say to a grant writer, you know, showing that you've got those links. Yeah, anything else? Yeah, it kind of brings it to life. I think you can have a couple of quotes, and obviously you'd need consent from the individual to do that. I mean, I don't, as well with the first one, the name's different. I don't know if you noticed that. Like if you're using real names in case studies to stuff, like that doesn't show great safeguarding. Especially if you're saying she's a vulnerable young person and you'll find her at St. Peter's High School in Stoke-on-Trent, you know, that is a big no-no, isn't it? You know, alarm bells are going there. Other stuff, anyone else on the differences? No, there was another thing that perhaps you didn't notice, but there's no reference in this case study, and this was intentional, to God. And it's quite controversial, but what I can tell you about this organisation is that they are attached to a church, they are fully Christian, love Jesus, and are doing it out of that place of knowing Jesus and wanting to have an impact. That the Beloved course is completely inspired by the Bible, and it talks about your identity in God and in Christ as sons and daughters, and the dignity and the beauty that you have, all that kind of stuff. But actually, this case study, without that, is still a really good case study that you can present to funders. Now, there are perhaps other things that you could add, like they also do a Youth Alpha as part of their youth club and other things. But actually, it's important that one of my favourite Bible verses is from Matthew, where Jesus says to the disciples, you're going to go out by like sheep amongst the wolves, and that you're to be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. And for me, in my grant writing, you were not being deceptive when we're talking about the kind of social outcomes that we're seeing. But within the grant application for one of the people that received this case study, they were very upfront that they're a church and they're an organisation and they're doing what they're doing as a result of what they believe. But that what they are doing in that context has huge social outcomes. And as a result of them being quite shrewd and quite wise about how they're articulating those outcomes, they're able to access far greater funding for their mission and for the purposes that they're doing. Now, there are Christian funds and grant makers out there that love are really up for the the evangelizing. But the point I'm trying to make is, don't shoot yourself in the foot from excluding a whole realm of funding that you might be able to access if you're just quite shrewd and wise about how you position what you're doing. And it's not being dishonest. It's not being, you know, it's not being manipulative in that way. And I think the Christian fundraisers on that panel that I talked about before, you know, I think increasingly they see that it's really important that we are just upfront and honest about who we are and what we do. Because actually so many of the big grant givers out there recognize that some of the organizations that are doing fantastic work is the church. You know, there's a wide acceptance of that is the case. And now some might be very suspicious about proselytizing, and I think sometimes you have to be quite clear that this project that we're running here is purely to serve the community. We do other activities over here, which is a bit more about how we share the gospel and discipleship and all that kind of stuff. But I think just by introducing some clever, subtle things into what you do, actually you can secure funding. And I think, I hope I've made that point well enough. So what are funders looking for? What are they asking? There are some general questions that almost every grant giver would be asking you. And essentially it's the who are you? What is your organisation? What do you do? And it should be relatively easy for you to answer that. What are you going to do? So what's your project plan? What is the thing that you're trying to do? Why are you going to do it? So that's kind of going into the need, answering some of those questions. How will you make an impact? So how is your project, how is the work that you're doing going to make an impact to that individual's lives on a micro and perhaps on a larger scale? And often attached to that question is, what outcomes are you expecting? And I think having really realistic outcomes is really good. So it could be something like, we are going to improve the self-esteem and confidence of 50 young people in 12 months. And you could measure that quite easily by maybe doing a questionnaire with those young people at the end of those 12 months. And it could just be in an informal setting or something like that. And it'd be fairly easy to kind of monitor and do. How much will it cost is always going to be a question. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the money side in a few seconds. So they'll be asking questions like, who else is funding you? Where else are you getting your money from? How much have you raised so far already? And like one of this is like the exit strategy question that you'll find in most grant applications. What are your plans beyond this grant? So if you're only asking for this money for 12 months, what's going to happen at the end of that 12 months? And having a clear idea about what you do. I mean, you might decide that you're piloting something for 12 months and that you'll see, and that might secure more money and you'll be able to continue. There's no right or wrong answer, but it's just being clear to funders that you've actually thought about what's going to happen at the end. And if it's just a 12-month project, one-off thing, great. You've got a pilot of something that you could go to other funders and say, we did this here, we've tweaked it, we've taken on the feedback, and now we're going to be doing it in this way. And I think as well, when you've got projects that you've already been running, being that wise and shrewd, sometimes you can be almost reinvent what you're already doing or package it together under a new project title, and that can help to access funding. You know, I oversaw homeless services at Caritas, and we were doing, we had a massive homeless drop-in centre called the Cornerstone Centre in Moss Side, which had about 150 people coming through the doors every day. We were accommodating 30 plus people through these pods that we had, which was like our night shelter, and we also had some houses. Now, we were already doing that, but I came up with a new project title called Doorsteps from the Street to the Suite, which is like a step-by-step process of what we've learned and what we're planning to do in the future. And it's like that was able to access more funding. Now, we were already doing that work, but just by being able to package it and articulate it in a way, it was able to access more funding. So it's that kind of sometimes when you're looking for continuation funding, there are people out there. Henry Smith, they're a Christian Charitable Trust, they do fund continuation projects. So what they're looking for is that actually you've already been running it for a year or 2 years, and if you're now looking for salaries because you've lost the funding for the salaries or stuff, they love to look at that kind of thing. Great. And then how long will it take? When will it start? Is another key question. So just to go on to some top tips, really important that you do your research around about the grant makers. There's literally thousands out there, from the obscure, like some fund from a Victorian businessman who left his money in a foundation. He had a very specific heart for the people of Merseyside around some really, really weird criteria, you know. And so there's that kind of level. And then there's the big grant givers, you know, the Esme Fairbairn, Big Lottery, Henry Smith, Garfield Weston, those kind of people who have, you know, staff and people working these all the time. And there's a real mix. So it's important that you do your research about that individual who you're applying to. Make sure you're eligible. This is something that people waste so many hours and times on writing grants and bids, and they've not read the criteria. Like, and it's just, there's just no point doing it unless you know what their outcomes are. And it goes back to, it's a science and an art. It's making sure what you're trying to achieve, you articulate it in a way that's also meeting their outcomes, but you're doing it without undermining your own vision and vision, you know, for what you're doing. And that's another key thing. You can get into a grant writing cycle of chasing the money, having to serve all these other outcomes, and you kind of lose sight of what you were trying to do in the first place. And I would say, make sure you're very clear about your mission and your vision and keep revisiting that, and make sure who you're applying to, you fit their criteria and it fits your criteria at the same time. Give them a call if there's any doubt. Like, some of these obscure ones, like I said, they might have one person who's a secretary that you won't be able to call, but it will say on their website if they're up for a phone call. I always found speaking to the funders to be quite helpful, because you're kind of building up a little bit of a relationship. You're giving the heads up on their project. So before you waste hours and hours writing in a grant application, you could just say, listen, this is the project's idea. This is what we're trying to do. Is that the kind of thing that you would fund? And they'll give you some helpful hints whether yes, that is, or no, it isn't. So making a phone call can be really helpful. Tailoring your application is kind of really important. In the same way that, you know, a HR department that receives a generic CV from someone applying for a job can sniff that out a mile away, if you're just sending the same application to funders again and again and again without kind of tailoring it and tweaking it a bit, you know, people, they sniff that out, they know. You know, if you're talking about outcomes that don't really interest them, they'll know that you've just chucked it in there without really thinking about it. Be very clear and concise. So many grant makers now, and more, are asking you to do it in a couple of pages or a four-page project proposal, which is far easier to do than a multi-stage application to the big lottery that can take 12 months. You know, there's lots of funders that like it to be concise. You know, and being a trustee for the people that give out, when we receive every month reams and reams of applications, we like people to be concise about what they're saying. Stuff like the case studies and supporting documents, that was a page long. Try and, you know, don't be any more than that when you're using supporting documents like that. More is less, as they say. Provide all the information requested. So it's important to keep it concise, but there might be specific questions that they're asking of you. And appearance matters. So they know that funding might be light, but actually just the structure of it, making sure it's really clear, that the subheadings, that kind of stuff, that it's not just reams and reams of text. Even when it's a box and it asks you a question, break it up with some bullet points or some subheadings. Just make it a little bit more accessible. And then another thing is, ask for feedback at the end. Whether you know, sometimes they'll give it when you get it. Sometimes they won't give feedback. Sometimes they're just too busy to do that. But actually, it's quite useful, because if it turns out that you don't meet the criteria, because actually their objectives as a trust aren't aligned with yours, it'd be really good to know that so that you don't go back to them the following year. So you're not wasting your time on that kind of stuff. And obviously with feedback, you can improve as well. And the final thing is this, invest in fundraising. And what I mean by this, not necessarily paying someone like me to come and help you, but make sure, because it is quite time consuming to kind of decipher the eligibility criteria, you know, looking online, looking at applications, that kind of stuff. But actually, there are some resources out there that I'm going to talk about that will help, a little shortcuts, stuff that cuts that out, things that you can invest in. And there's a lot of free resources out there as well that you'll be able to access that will help you cut out some of that stuff. Some of the really other important stuff, and we're doing for time, yeah, right, and is this. It's really important that you know your vision, and I keep saying it, and your mission. You know, do you have a really clear like mission statement as an organisation, or does your church? Is it something that can just roll off the tongue if you're in a conversation with someone? You know, when I worked at Rock, it was people of goodwill working together for safer kind of communities. You know, and we could go into almost any meeting and be like, that's the vision and purpose of our organisation. And in that is so much, because people of goodwill is churches, but it's also other organisations that have goodwill and that they're looking to partner with. So it's really important that you have a clear vision and mission. Low-hanging fruit. This is one of the strategies I talk to when I talk to prospective clients, is actually there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there, perhaps smaller to medium-sized grant applications within your community, within your region. Go for that stuff first. And it could be a collection of £2,000, £1,000, £5,000 applications. But if you're writing applications, it's a bigger, better investment of your time. Often by writing 10 applications to these smaller ones, the return might be better when you're starting out than spending the same amount of time going straight for like a big lottery application. So go for the low-hanging fruit, I would say, and then go from there. Maximize local support. All your local links, like the CVSs, the voluntary sector community groups that support organizations within your community. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Maximize connections, leads, contacts. Are there people in your church who are linked to people in trusts and foundations, or people who are businessmen who have pots of money or links? Actually, again, it's that kind of be wise and be shrewd about who you're targeting. Recently, I wrote an application to a grant-making trust who don't receive applications anymore. They only do it by relationship. So they'll only give out money from the people that the trustees know and link with. And one of the founders of this organisation had written a book. So I read her book and I wrote her a personal letter from this organisation while I was working for them, and just said how much their book inspired me, this, that and the other. A couple of weeks later, I sent another letter with a proposal from this charity. And even though they don't accept applications, they ended up having a face-to-face meeting with this charity and have given them £15,000. So sometimes, you know, if you've got some kind of warm lead or connection, and I did have a couple of like fairly distant connections with this trust, but I was able to kind of talk about that, and the book did inspire me. I wasn't lying. You know, it was amazing to hear about this journey that this Christian lady had been on. Yeah. I'd be giving stuff away if I say that. I've been trying not to, because I don't want to bombard them with like letters of people who've read their book. Sorry. But yeah, let me have a think about that, and I'll see if I can tell you at the end and not anyone else. Okay. So yeah, important to maximise those contacts and leads. Case for support. Make sure the case that you're making is really good. And having a document sometimes that's like your master grant application, where you've answered some of those questions before, that when you then approach a new grant person, you can go to your case for support and say, right, copy and paste that, stick that there, copy and paste that, stick that there. You've actually probably done the majority of the legwork, and you just need to tweak it and refine it a little bit. So having a good case for support is helpful. And it's not just helpful for grant makers, it's helpful for other people that you're going to be working with in the community. Further down the line, you might find actually the size and the scale of what you're doing are merits that actually you need to think a bit more strategically about your fundraising, about those different areas, and how you're going to do that, what you're going to invest from your budget in that year towards those efforts, that kind of thing. You know, the Message Trust here will have a fundraising strategy. They have a fundraising team that they're trying to use in various ways to kind of make sure that they're generating the income they need to deliver their mission. You know, it is an important piece of work, but it doesn't need to be arduous. It can be just quite simple and basic if you're just starting out. Get someone to proofread your grant application. if that's particularly an area that you know you struggle with. But yeah, if there's not time, obviously proofread it yourself, but you always miss stuff. You know, I write grants all the time and I'll go back to it. Every time I go back to it, I'll make a change or I'll spot something. So actually having fresh eyes on something can be really good. Some of the supporting documents that I mentioned that you might require. So the reason I asked that question at the beginning, are you a registered charity? A lot of times people want to see that you're registered with a charity commission, that there's a regulatory body that's over you. Therefore, the church's audited accounts from the previous year will need to be submitted. So if you're brand new and you're just starting out, you're not going to have that. But for the smaller grants and trusts in your locality, that won't be a barrier. You can provide like bank statement or something like that. But for the larger ones like Garfield Weston, they won't even look at you unless you've got a year of operating and you've got some evidence to show that you're financially viable and there's accountants looking at what you're doing. And it's all about transparency and excellence, which is what we're about anyway, I think, as a church. And yeah, go for it.
We sort of operate as a non-registered charity currently.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
But we can show, and it's been that way for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
That's, for us, that's the, at the moment, okay.
Yeah.
We can operate from that.
Yeah.
So is that, does it have to be a year having been registered, or can you utilise the fact that you've got history and show?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Like, so a homeless organisation I work for had only just registered as a CIO, so a charity. It's a different type of charity. It's more like it looks more like a business as well as a charity. But they have evidence of being small and operating. So actually, some of the grant makers, so Garfield Weston, for example, gave them £10,000 because actually they could evidence that they were still doing stuff prior to being registered as a charity. So there's often ways around these things if you can show and demonstrate that that's what you've been doing. Policies, just making sure stuff like if you're working with young people, you've got safeguarding policies that can often be a supporting document. Quotations you might get if you're asking for money for equipment or whatever, important that you've got those things. If you're asking for salaries, maybe just having a job description, often that would be asked for from some organisations, not always. And again, you can get job description templates offline and you could fill them yourselves, you know, if you haven't already got them. Case studies is what we talked about. I think is fantastic. It tells a story, proves what you're saying you're doing and is having an impact. And then other marketing information, like an annual report or a newsletter, stuff like that. You know, Garfield Weston, ask for that. They also, there's an option for Garfield Weston to do a video. So you could submit, it has to be related to the project. So it can't just be like a music video that inspired you, but it, you know, something that's related. So it could just be you do a Voxbox interview with you and one of your team about the work that you're doing, and they'll look at that and they'll consider that. So that's another supporting thing that you can do. And then letters of endorsement. You know, are there people in your community? Are there local councillors? Church leaders, people that could just kind of write a letter of support or a letter of endorsement to, you know, people who are respected or credible or whatever, that could do that on your behalf. That all helps. Getting the money bit right is important as well. This is just an example of a project kind of budget that I wrote for a charity. So it's a two-year budget. I don't expect you to see or the writing, but for me, in here you've got a project leader full-time salary, and that includes on costs, so your employer's not NIC, and pension, admin assistance in there. I've got recruitment costs, supervision, so the line management. So for me, I always try and put in as many of the real costs as possible. So costs that will be coming back, that actually it does take time for you to sit down once a week with that person. So how much does that cost you? You can make some pretty crude calculations, but I'm just really passionate about people applying for the money that actually that they're spending to do this stuff. And you might, you know what, you might not get it all, but you might get some coming back to help you carry on doing what you're doing as an organisation. So being quite, again, quite wise and shrewd about what you put in there. Training costs, publicity, refreshments, volunteer time. This, for me, is really important, especially when you're saying, when they ask the question, how much have you raised so far? You could say, actually, we've got 20 volunteers giving 5 hours a week. If you worked on the national living wage, times that by that amount, this is the value of the volunteers' time, and it equates to whatever it is in this, it was £22,000. So I've put that in my project budget as a expenditure item, and on the next page, I've put it as confirmed income, as you know, money that we've got in. So it's money in, money out, but it's kind of demonstrating that actually when you come to it, you could say, you know, hand on heart, we're looking for £20,000. We've already raised £20,000 through in-kind support. And it just, it helps, these little things help when grant givers are looking at supporting you, because it shows that we're not just looking for 100% of the money. A lot of grant givers will only give like 50% or 20% or whatever. So they want to see that other people are invested in you. And I include other stuff. You know, you might have a percentage of the tithe that comes into the church that you're linked with. Maybe they give you an amount of money to do the work that you do. Put it in there. Show that that's an income in it, and it's money that's already coming in. It all helps. And then I've separated out, so volunteer expenses, insurance, monitoring and evaluation. A lot of big grant givers expect monitoring and evaluation, so put it as a cost. So for here, I've put it as 5% of the total project costs, which equates to £3,400. These are all things that you'll have to do 12 months into your project, so build those costs into your project budgets where you're eligible to do that. And central support costs. So you might be part of a bigger organisation, and for them to do the HR, finance, admin, for you to do what you do, maybe there's a chunk of money that could go back to them to help them to keep doing what they're doing. So all that kind of stuff. You don't have to include, but it's can be helpful, and a lot of grant givers would happily give it because it's a real cost. And then you've got capital costs, so that could be buildings and whatever, but equipment, laptops, materials, resources, that kind of stuff. And then these my templates always follow this kind of similar format of expenditure, revenue and capital, and then confirmed income shortfall. So for this, I think we're asking for £80,000 in year one, 78 in year two. I'm saying we've got this because we've already got a grant, so we're 50% of the way there. It's just a little bit more appealing to grant makers, and we're only looking for the 36. These are all the other grants we've written to. There's £53,000 out there. We might get some, we might not get, might not get it all. It's just all good to make sure you're getting the money right. Okay, quickly, I'm just going to go through some of these resources that, you know, please take a note of. So fundingcentral.org.uk, it's really useful. If you're under, if your annual income is under £100,000, you don't have to pay for this, but you'll get a monthly, it might be weekly, update that matches your funding criteria of trusts and grants that are available. What's really useful about that is they'll often give the ones with the deadline that is closest to your date. So you can be quite targeted in who you apply to, because if you know that their trustees are meeting next month, you know the turnaround for your grant application is probably 2 months and not 6 months or a year, which sometimes it can be. So you can be quite targeted about, you know, the ones that you might hear back from a bit sooner. So that's a really good, that's offered by NCVO. The FSI as well, you can become a member. This is an organisation, the Foundation for Social Improvement. They do free training around the country on various things, like, you know, like grant writing, case for support. I think there's just like a £10 admin fee, but I really recommend them. They're really helpful. This, what I was saying about the local, So this local CVSs, make sure you're trying to plug in them. For here in Manchester, we've got MAC, which is the Manchester's local voluntary and community sector support organisation, and then GMCVO, which is the Greater Manchester one. Tie into these organisations because they have funding alerts. They'll do newsletters with opportunities that come up. They're liaising with health and social care services. They'll be able to tell you where some of the opportunities are. And this website, if you don't know who your local organisation is, this is the network for all of those across the country. So you can go on there and say, find a member, and it'll give you a map where all of them are, so you can just check where your ones are. And just build relationships with these individuals. You know, it's really good. Go along to some of the events that they might put on. Who knows what will come from that. This, if you prefer paper-based, this might be useful to you. I call it kind of the grant writer's Bible. It's a book that's that thick, that's got, you know, over 2,000 funders in there, the information about them, how much they give, how much they award in different areas. It's £125 per copy, which is quite expensive. But again, when you're talking about investing, actually that might be quite useful. What I found quite useful in that document, at the back of it, there's an index. So it will look at, it'll categorize it. So there'll be Christian and faith based, or there'll be youth work, or there'll be, you know, and you can then look at the relevant page where those opportunities are, and you can be quite targeted. And then there's other services. Sorry, go on.
Does that get updated like every year or something?
Yeah, every year.
So you have to pay that every year?
No. Because there's not that much change.
Okay.
Even if you got your hands on a copy that's a couple of years old, or you could, you know, it would be fine. But there are new grant givers all the time that come out. And so the charity I was just involved with prior to becoming part of Kingdom Fundraising was Catholic. And the amount of money that you used to get through legacies, people dying and leaving money and stuff, it was amazing. And it would just be like that shortfall for the year, we'd suddenly just get that legacy that kind of fit that, and it was kind of cool. But the quick save, so Albert Goube, who's the founder, he died a couple of years ago, but he left all of his money in a foundation, because he said very early on in his career to God, if I'm successful, I'm going to leave my money to the church. So, which is effectively, you know, what the foundation has been set up to do. So there are new ones that come up, but obviously there's already 2,000 in there or whatever. And again, you know, as we started with prayer and thanksgiving, the amount of times I just sit at my computer and desk and I'll start and like, please, Lord, just help me today. Help me, inspire me to the places and the people, and to write the things that I need to write to help secure this funding for this project that I know that you care about, and it is your heart. And I think it's just quite releasing, because if it's a yes, it's a yes, or it's a no, that doesn't change like what you're doing in any way. So that's it from what I've been saying. Has anyone got any questions? I've been asking questions on the way. That they want to ask. Yeah?
Do you have a hedge of bets? So, say you've got something that requires a grant for £5,000, and you come in at that deadline where you might have to lose a member of staff or whatever basis. Do you just apply for one? Or would you apply for a couple?
So I'm going to repeat that so I've got it on the microphone. So you're asking if you hedge your bets, so apply for the same amount to multiple places. Do that all the time. Yeah. I've been in an awkward position before when you get a few of them, and you know, you might have to go back to them and be honest and say, listen, we've secured this from you, but we've also secured this. You know, we can give you the money back, or let me tell you about this other project that we're doing in this other area that you might be interested in. You know, it's just being quite wise. We got 350k for that homeless project, and my backup plan was a 150k grant to another organisation, and we got that as well. So I had to go back to them and say, we're going to slightly change what we said we were going to do for you and this fund this other area. Are you up for that? And they were. So, you know, have the conversation. The worst you can do, you've still got the money that you said you asked for, so I think it's fine to do that. Yeah. Any other? Yes.
On the
applying for a small grant a little while back, and was asking for our governing document. And we're affiliate members of the Baptist Union, so not a separate charity. At the time, our only document was our constitution of the church, which was basically a biblical understanding of how you appoint elders and deacons.
Yeah.
So I was quite rushed anyway, so I didn't end up putting in the grant. But yeah, when they say our governing document, what does that look like?
So you might sometimes. Yeah, and there are, in actual fact, a lot of new charities are going down the CIO route or CIC, so Charitable Incorporated Organization, and there's template governance documents on there. So it's stuff like, you know, how do you vote in your trustees, that kind of stuff. That's kind of like pretty standard. So, you know, if you're struggling, you can use the templates and tweak them accordingly, you know, for how you do that and how the structure works. It's just proving that you've got governance and that if it all goes belly up, you know, that there's some accountability there. Yeah, you had a question, sorry.
Yeah, it's just in terms of kingdom fundraising, what kind of percentage do you take of any grants?
It's a good question. I get that question all the time. I don't work on a commission basis. So I'm an affiliated member to the Institute of Fundraising, and they've taken the kind of moral position that actually it's unethical to charge commission. Now, I say that knowing that a lot of people do charge commission, but it's unethical because you can get a really successful grant writer securing £1 million for an organisation, and is it right that then they get 10% cut of that? It's a big amount of money, and as a grant giver, if I saw a professional cost in there for a grant writer, I'd be saying, we're not funding that. We won't fund that. Yeah, it's fine that people go and do that, but don't, you know, have it somewhere else. So I work on a contract basis. So I'll come and we'll have a conversation and we'll talk about your needs and the project. And I'll come back with, say, you know, 5 days of work. And I basically just have a really simple rate, because I want to be more affordable to smaller charities. So I have a rate for smaller charities under £1 million turnover, and then a rate for over £1 million turnover. So it's quite wide. Probably need to update it at some point. But that's partly because I'm passionate about wanting smaller organisations to access stuff. And to be honest as well, if you're having to wait 12 months to hear back from a grant, if I was waiting 12 months before I got paid, like, I'm not going to be able to support my family in the way that, you know, I need to. So that's another reason. Yeah. Any more? Great. Well, I think that's a natural end. And you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Kingdom Fundraising. And yeah, it's been great. And I really hope and pray that all your efforts, that actually God will bless that. And actually, that's the difference between us and other people. We've got the favour of the Lord on us and what we're doing, and so be praying that in, and yeah, it'll be exciting to see what happens. Great.
Can we give a big thank you?
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out message.org.uk to find out how you can support or even get involved with one of our teams.